Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Thomas Piketty. Thomas is professor at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales and the Paris School of Economics. He's also the co-director of the World Inequality Lab. He's quite famous. I know you know him, but I'm going to signal some of his New York Times bestsellers, Capital in the 21st Century and Capital and Ideology. And he's the author of a recently published book by Harvard University Press called A Brief History of Equality. We're going to be talking with him about the book and his career. Thank you very much for being here with us, Thomas.
Thanks for inviting me.
So you're one of the best known economists in the world, but I don't know how many people know about you before and your career before Capital in the 21st Century. Why don't you tell us a bit about you? What's your story? How did you end up becoming someone interested in inequality from an economic history perspective? Tell us a bit about that, please.
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in history, and I guess, you know, I first studied mathematics in France because, you know, in my country there's a strong incentive to do math when you are good at math. But basically, I was more interested in history from the beginning. So I went to economics as a way to sort of shift towards the social sciences. I did my PhD in Paris and at LSE through a European doctoral program arrangement that existed at the time. Then I was hired as an assistant professor of economics at MIT back in 1993. So this is, you know, almost 30 years ago. I was a baby. You know, I was 22 at the time, and I was doing, you know, very mathematical oriented modeling. I knew nothing at all about economics, and I found it a bit strange, you know, to be hired as an assistant professor by MIT, as I didn't know anything. And, you know, I was very honored. I was very interested by the years I spent in the US. But at the same time, it puzzled me a little bit about the discipline, the fact that you could, you know, be very successful just by proving math theorem. And I think this partly contributed, you know, to you know, my decision to shift to more historical research. You know, I didn't want to spend all of my life proving math theorems about. I mean, mathematics is beautiful, but then you should do real math, and not. I think mathematics applied to economics, and most importantly, you know, I realized that you had all this historical data coming from income tax, inheritance tax for France, for many European countries, for the US, all over the world, which had never been really exploited in a systematic manner. And so I started doing that, now more than 20 years ago. And it became international comparative project, which we now have in the World Inequality Database, which is a very collective research project that has, where we've been able to put together the effort of over 100 researchers all over the world. And, all the books I have written, in a way, are very much, have been made possible by this collective research program. And to a large extent, what I've been doing is to pursue a tradition of research, which you can see in the French Annales School of Economic and Social History, trying to build historical series and income, wages, etc. I'm also very much influenced, of course, by the Anglo-Saxon tradition on national accounts and historical study on income distribution that was pioneered by Simon Kuznets and in the US, Tony Atkinson in Britain. And, I've been trying to push this research agenda further. So I've been, at a personal level, I've been back in Paris pretty soon after my stay at MIT. I mean, I enjoyed a lot the US, but not sufficiently to shift country permanently. And so I came back to Paris and to this school, the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales, where, Braudel was the first president a long time ago, and where the Annales School, partly developed. And I've been developing this international network of researchers with many friends actually based in California, including Emmanuel Saez and Gabriel Zucman at Berkeley, and with people from all over the world, we've been pushing this agenda of building historical series on income and wealth inequality, going back sometime to the early 19th century or to the late 18th century, and offering broad historical comparative perspective on inequality. So this is what has kept me busy for more than 20 years now.
Can I ask you something more about that? Because that's a very unconventional path for a scholar, I would say. And although you've been quite successful building a fantastic and very interesting research agenda, I can imagine that at the time when you're making all these decisions of leaving the US after being a professor, deciding to move from a more formal type of research to one that it's more based on primary sources, also considering starting to write books, probably at the expense of writing more articles. Like, I'm trying to think about how did this feed into the pressure of the system? I don't know. Did you have some opposition from your mentors? How did you navigate that? I'm very curious about that.
I was very lucky in a way because I had some very, early recognition from the discipline. I was a young assistant prof at MIT. I had, top journal publication in economics. I could sort of afford, it was relatively easy for me to say, now I want to calm down, to take a few years just to write a big book. And that's what I'm going to do. And I should say it's also the advantage of, I think, going back to France and going back to a school of social sciences where colleagues in history, in sociology, in anthropology actually value the kind of long-term project, in particular book writing, which economists unfortunately don't always value a lot. And I think had I stayed at in an economics department at US university, say at MIT, maybe I would not have done that, because indeed the pressure to keep writing the kind of short articles at which you are good at is very strong. And so partly for personal reason, but also partly for intellectual reason, I was very happy to return to Europe. And I think overall this has been very beneficial.
That's great. And it's also very inspiring for for me in particular. I'm Colombian and I'm in the US, but you know, I experienced also some of the interest and I'm aware of the pressures of the system for doing something that is not necessarily coherent with those interests. But let's get now to your book, right? So the book, it's called A Brief History of Equality. I think that already anticipates a lot of what it's inside the book, right? So the first thing is that it's brief. And I said on Twitter that we were going to have this conversation. And someone said a brief history, like Piketty doing a brief history, that doesn't sound to be very consistent with your previous work, which is rather monumental, to put it in a certain way. And the equality part of it, it's also interesting. Like usually when you think about your subject of research, it's frequently framed as inequality, right? So why is this a brief history of equality and not a long history of inequality, for instance?
Well, first, it's brief. You know, it's a 250-page book or so. So, you know, I have made a lot of effort. I try you know, to write a sort of concise version of, you know, what I wrote before. You know, I realize, you know, I've written three big books around 1,000 pages each on the history of the distribution of income and wealth. And the first one was Top Incomes in France in the 20th Century, that was published in 2001, then Capital in the 21st Century in 2013, and finally Capital and Ideology in 2019. And, you know, these books were becoming bigger and bigger. You know, the last one, Capital and Ideology, is even 50% bigger than Capital in the 21st Century, which was already very big. And, you know, I realized that, you know, this was getting out of hand. You know, I mean, I don't regret that I wrote these books, because, you know, I learned a lot by writing them. And, you know, I think it makes sense for a number of purposes to write big books. But, you know, I think I've gone a bit too far in this direction. And, you know, at some point I thought, okay, you have to be more concise. And to write something, you know, to write something that people can actually read, you know, in 2 or 3 days, and not, you know, they don't need weeks and weeks and weeks to read it. That's the first, you know, difference between this book and the previous one. The second difference, which is maybe even more important, is that, as you said, you know, I stress very much in this new book, the optimistic dimension, because, you know, by trying to summarize, you know, what were really the most important findings of my research, I came to realize that in the end, you know, probably the most important conclusion is that we do observe a long run movement toward more equality in income, in wealth, but also more political equality, more, you know, gender equality, racial equality. You know, of course, this is still very much imperfect, but if you look at the long run picture, starting sometime, you know, at the end of the 18th century, so particular with the French Revolution, the US Revolution to some extent, you have a movement, you know, say between 1780 and 2020, which goes toward more equality. So this is not a movement, you know, this does not happen just like this. You know, this comes from political mobilization, sometimes from revolution, revolts, you know, trade union mobilization, elections, social struggles. But, you know, this really goes in this long run direction. This is a movement that starts, as I said, you know, with, you know, the end of aristocratic privileges, in particular during the French Revolution, and also the slave revolt in Saint-Domingue in 1791, which sort of marks the beginning of the end of slave and colonial societies. Now, of course, it takes a very long time. You know, you in the 19th century, you have the abolition of slavery, the beginning of the labor movement, of labor rights, the rise of male suffrage. And in the 20th century, you have the rise of female suffrage, you have independence war, you have the rise of social security, progressive taxation. You know, at the end of the 20th century, you have the end of apartheid. You know, you have the beginning of a movement toward more gender equality, toward against racial discrimination. And, you know, this movement toward more equality is, of course, continuing today. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress, but we still live, for instance, if you think of our democratic ideal, you know, I think we still live in societies where the power of money to influence elections, to influence politics, to influence the media is much bigger than what a true, you know, democratic societies should look like. The concentration of wealth and properties is much bigger than what it should be. You know, it's not as extreme as one century ago or two centuries ago. So, you know, when I say there's a long-run movement toward equality, you know, I'm not saying this to conclude, okay, everything is great, we should just be happy about everything, but rather to the conclusion is, okay, we should continue in this direction. And how are we going to continue in this direction? Well, you know, probably the first step is to better understand, you know, how this positive evolution toward more equality and more prosperity at the same time, because these two movements of the modernization process, you know, really came together. How this happened, and you know, what can we learn from this to you know, to continue in this direction?
Right. So, so most of the forces that you describe in what you just said are of, let's say, a national level, right? So it's basically societies that, through different processes, decide to make reforms that make them more egalitarian, I guess. But in the book, you explore some dimension of inequality that is very interesting, which is, I guess, what you could call of international level, right? And you talk about slavery and about colonialism. So why don't you tell us a bit about that? What has been the role of those type of international institutional arrangements and inequality, and how should we think about them in the present?
Yes, so you're right. You know, slavery and colonialism, you know, played a major role in the process of industrialization and more generally, you know, in the process of wealth creation. You know, the Western countries developed by you know, organizing the world economic system in a particular way, with a specific form of division of labor, exploitation of natural resources. You know, at the eve of the U.S. Civil War, nearly three quarters of the cotton that was used in the manufacturing industry in Northeast United States, but also in Britain, but also in the rest of Europe, came from you know, the plantations, the slavery plantations of U.S. South. So, you know, this is not saying that industrialization could not happen without slavery. You know, you can imagine another trajectory with a more equitable labor regime, a different distribution of power, a different distribution of income. But, you know, this requires some imagination, and this requires a different power, you know, situation, a different power relation, you know, at the global level between, you know, the different forces at play. So in any case, this is the trajectory from which we come. You know, none of us today, of course, is responsible for this trajectory, but we are all individually responsible for deciding to take this into account or not in our analysis of the modern world. And so in my book, for instance, you know, I talk about the issue of reparation, which, you know, I think is an important issue that is not going to go away like this. So, for instance, you know, in the case of Haiti, which was the first, you know, the first slave revolt in Saint-Domingue at the time of the French Revolution, gave rise to the Republic of Haiti, except that the French state in 1825 forced Haiti, in order to, you know, recognize the independence of Haiti, Haiti had to pay to France, you know, an enormous war tribute, so to speak, which was the equivalent of 3 years of GDP, of output of Haiti at the time, in order to compensate the French slave owners for their loss of property. Now, of course, this was impossible to repay in 1 year. So the French bankers, you know, came in and proposed generously to refinance this debt with enormous interest rate, of course. And IT ended up repaying this debt, you know, from 1825 up until the 1950s. You know, you have payment from IT to the Banque de France until 1957. I mean, it's a long story. Some of the debt was resold to US bankers in the interwar period. Anyway, but to make a long story short, you know, there is this very well documented payment, from Haiti to France, which basically the money was used to compensate French slave owners for their loss of property. Now, what do you do with this kind of history, you know, when you are today in 2022? It's always complicated to set the right system of reparation. You know, I make proposal on the book on this specific case, and I argue that that France should repay, you know, the equivalent of maybe 30 billion euros or dollars of today to IT. You know, I'm not saying I know the exact formula to set the right number, etc. You know, this has to come from democratic deliberation and decision making process, and you know, it's certainly very complicated, but it's too simple to say, okay, this is a long time ago, we should just forget about it and we don't care about it. Because, you know, these payments are very well documented and took place until the 1950s. And, you know, there are expropriation and various injustices that took place, you know, during World War II or even sometime during World War I, which we are still compensating today. And rightly so. And you know, in my country, in France, you had to wait until 1999, so a little more than 20 years ago, to have a new commission to look at the Jewish expropriation during World War II and to set up reparation. Now, if you tell IT, well, in your case, you know, you had payments that were made in 1950 until the 1950s to compensate French slave owners for their loss of property, and we're not going to do anything, and you know, this is too old, and you know, you're putting yourself in a very complicated situation when it comes to constructing norms of justice that are universal and which look universal and which are universal. So let me make be very clear. You know, we are not going to solve all the problem of the world today with reparation. You know, we need to look at the future. And, you know, in my book, in my work, I look at, structural transformation of the international tax system today so that poor countries, you know, including Haiti, including countries in sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, have a decent share of tax revenue coming from corporate taxation. So, you know, we have to look at the future. We cannot just look at reparation. But what I argue is that we need to do both. You know, if you don't, do something about past injustices in a way that is fair, or at least that tries to treat the different injustices of the past in a way that is, you know, more or less equitable and more or less consistent, it is going to be very difficult to look at the future and to develop universal institutions to favor redistribution. You know, when I propose, for instance, you know, minimum inheritance for all, I don't propose to look as to whether your ancestors were slaves or slave owners or white or black or whatever. You know, if you have universal healthcare, you know, it should be universal. The minimum inheritance, it should be universal. So, you know, I favor universal policy to reduce inequality. But at the same time, there are also, you know, reparations for specific injustices of the past that also need to be taken seriously. And, you know, of course, it's a difficult articulation to try to care about, you know, both aspects. And, that's why, you know, we have difficulties sometimes making progress in the direction of equality. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think this is the only way. And, you know, I think it's possible. I think through democratic deliberation, I think we can find our way. And, you know, in this example of Haiti and, you know, post-colonial reparation, in my case, it took me a long time and a lot of research, you know, to realize that this is the way things took place, and you know, this is the way we should try to address this legacy, in because this is typically, this is not part of the curriculum. You know, I think this is not part of what you are being taught at school. You know, I grew up in France in the 1970s, so this was just a decade after decolonization, or 10, 20 years after decolonization. But you know, in my country, you know, people, you know, the way children were taught about history at school was as if, you know, colonial empires never existed. You know, it was, and I guess, you know, partly because the country was, you know, wanted to forget this past, you know, just like in the US, people want to forget the past of segregation, etc. But, you know, if you want to build another future, sometimes you have to confront this legacy, and you know, that's actually, you know, that's going to be difficult, but in the end, this is going to facilitate the construction of another world and a more equal future.
Fantastic, fantastic. Let me ask you one final question that I ask all my guests, which is, why writing a book? Why not transmitting your ideas in a different way?
Like
an article for a journal, for instance, or I know that you also write op-eds and so on, but like, why investing so many months writing a book?
Yeah, no, I write all the formats. You know, I write very short op-ed, you know, one page in Le Monde every month. You know, I go on radio every Friday morning to have a, you know, 15-minute debate about economic policies, which is listened by 4 million people, you know, and French radio every Friday. At the same time, I write 40-page articles for academic journals. And yes, I care even more about books. You know, I think books is, to me, the only format where you can really develop a fully articulated thought. Let me say this. Writing books is the only time when I feel I am really trying to think hard about a problem. You know, as long as you are not confronted to book writing, as long as you can just talk and talk and talk, or you can write a one-page article or talk for 15 minutes or even write a 30 or 40-page article, you are not really confronted to the difficult question. And I think, to me, it's only, you know, I feel it's really only by writing books that I have tried to come with sensible answers, you know, to big questions. And I'm, you know, I'm not claiming the answers I come with are fully satisfactory. You know, I keep changing my mind and making progress about these big questions. You know, I spend a lot of time reading what other people write, talking to people, and this makes me always, you know, come to a, you know, to a slightly different position and evolve. But at the end of the day, it's only in the format of book writing that I feel you can develop a fully articulated reasoning and thought about a question.
Well, thank you very much, Thomas. Thank you for writing this fascinating book, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks a lot, Javier.